the headlines, Russia says it has found documents in U.S. bio laboratories in Ukraine that show research was being done on dangerous pathogens there. A report says Saudi and Emirati leaders declined calls to the U.S. president as Washington's working to build international support for Ukraine and contain a surge in oil prices. And a Palestinian man succumbs to his injuries sustained in an earlier Israeli attack in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Our top story for this half hour, we begin with an important development about the reported biological laboratories operating in Ukraine. Russia now says it has documents proving that the United States has been developing bioweapons in Ukrainian territory. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova has urged the U.S. to explain to the world why it supported a military biological program in Ukraine. She drew attention to the fact Washington acknowledged this. Earlier on Tuesday, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland, admitted that Ukraine has biological research facilities. Media reports say the laboratories store large quantities of dangerous viruses and that Russia has found that Washington is using them for military programs. Reacting to the news, China is now urging Washington to release all details of the programs, but the UK Defense Ministry earlier refuted Moscow's claims, saying they are only meant to justify the military operation. With U.S. media reporting that Saudi and Emirati leaders have snubbed President Joe Biden and refused to speak to him in recent weeks. According to the Wall Street Journal, there's been some expectation of a phone call after earlier contacts by the White House were declined. Those calls never came. Biden was apparently meaning to encourage the two Arab producers to pump more oil into the market to bring down energy prices. In the U.S., Washington has been attempting to push an array of oil-producing countries, including its adversary Venezuela, to balance the impact of Russia's Ukraine attack on energy markets. The U.S. president is reportedly considering a trip to Saudi Arabia to resolve differences with Crown Prince bin Salman over a host of issues. Well, we're now joined by Mr. Iman Nasiri, Middle East Managing Director at Oil and Gas Market Consultancy. Mr. Nasiri, welcome to the program. Why have Abu Dhabi and Riyadh been snubbing the U.S. president up until now?
That's a good question, and one for political commentators, which I'm not. But I have to say that OPEC doesn't really want to be pressured by specific players in the market for their own benefit. I think Biden administration, well, U.S. presidents in the past have always tried to basically contact the OPEC producers, specifically in the past many contacts with the Saudi leaders when and if the gas price at the pump stations in the U.S. have elevated beyond certain points. So that has always been considered as a concern, as the only concern for the U.S., which is basically the consumer's cost of transportation. However, OPEC producers, including Saudi and the UAE, do that they are constantly, over the past several months, watching the market and trying to balance the oil market when an extra supply, and that's what they're doing regardless. Specific countries' costs should not be considered in this. That I assume is why they probably haven't made themselves available for this call. However, I have to say that in the last in their last meeting, OPEC producers concluded their meeting very, very short, and they decided that the supply has not been yet disrupted at that point in time, which was early March, March 2nd, I believe. But since then, I suppose things have changed, and so OPEC may decide against their normal track of production, incremental path, and raise their production output next in their meeting next month.
And what about the prolonged impact of the Ukraine conflict on energy markets? And can countries like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela balance that out?
It's very hard to say that there's anyone or even a group of countries who can balance total an entire Russia's output or exports to the market out. Russia exports 4.5 million barrels per day of crude and 2.5 million barrels of products in a normal situation to the market. That's 7 million barrels per day of oil equivalent, and there is no such spare capacity at the moment existence in the market by anyone or by any collective member of countries. However, Venezuela and Iran, who have been kept out of the market, have potential to increase their production. However, that's not immediately available for the market, immediately meaning next month or two, especially Venezuela, who have been out of the market for much longer and subject to a lot worse financial situation, haven't invested enough in their upstream basically fields, and they cannot ramp up production as quick as Iran could. So to answer your question, the answer is no. However, the OEA countries and the OECD countries have also tried to help by releasing some of their crude inventories from their strategic reserves to basically come and help this. And also on the other hand, we don't expect the entire 7 million barrels per day of Russian oil exports to go out of the market. Certainly China will continue to import crude and products from Russia, and that will basically help also the market to offset the balance with the spare capacity among OPEC producers.
All right, thanks a lot to Mr. Iman Asadi, Middle East Managing Director at Oil and Gas Market Consultancy, joining us from Dubai. Elsewhere, the West anti-Russia sanctions have been in the headlines ever since Moscow launched its attacks on Ukraine. Now, in a tit-for-tat move, Moscow is threatening to impose similar measures targeting the West. The Russian Foreign Ministry says it's working on a broad response to the sanctions, adding the measures will be swift and thoughtful, and that the pain will be felt in the West's most sensitive areas. On Tuesday, U.S. President Joe Biden imposed an immediate ban on Russian oil and other energy imports in reaction to its attacks on Ukraine. Other Western countries have also targeted Russia's financial and corporate system with crippling measures. The situation has pushed Russia's economy towards the gravest crisis it's faced since the 1991 fall of the Soviet Union. Gas prices in the U.S. hit an all-time high as President Joe Biden announces a full ban on energy supplies from Russia. Americans now have to pay an average of almost $4.2 per gallon at the gas pumps, surpassing the previous high in 2008. And now, with President Biden's ban on Russian oil and gas imports taking effect, the prices are expected to go up even more steeply. Russia exports more than 12% of the world's crude oil. Any supply disruption will affect the cost of oil globally. American households are also grappling with the highest inflation rate in over 40 years. In other news, another Palestinian has lost his life following an attack by the Israeli forces as tensions run high in the occupied territories. Palestinian sources say the 23-year-old man succumbed to his injuries sustained in an attack by troops in the city of Nablus a few days ago. The West Bank has been the scene of daily escalations, with Israeli forces killing several Palestinians within days. The UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process has expressed deep concern over the deteriorating security situation. Iran strongly condemns the latest Israeli missile strike against Syria as a criminal act of aggression, occupation, and assassination. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says responding to the regime's crimes against humanity is one of the main goals of the resistance campaign in the region. Israeli airstrikes hit targets near the Syrian capital, Damascus, on Monday. During that attack, two members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were killed. The IRGC has vowed to avenge the death of its members. In a statement, it said, "The Zionist regime will undoubtedly pay the price for its atrocity." There are a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria, as requested by the Damascus government. Carrying attacks on Syrian territory has become a common Israeli practice, and the Syrian government has on numerous occasions asked the United Nations to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its continued aggression. Iran's chief negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani is back in the Austrian capital after a one-day trip to Tehran for consultations with efforts to revive Iran's 2015 deal in the final stage. Now let's cross over to Vienna, where our correspondent Toma Lezgi is standing by with the latest. Toma, what do you have to share with us?
Yes, Fadio, what I'm hearing from sources close to the Iranian delegation here is that the outstanding issues are still on the table, being discussed in various negotiations between parties. And as you said, the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, is back now in Vienna, and he's expected to have meetings today, not yet announced officially, but we're expecting them to happen. Also, we know, of course, yesterday the IAEA Board of Governors was discussing the issue of Iran's nuclear activities, the IAEA's verification and monitoring in light of the JCPOA, which, of course, touched upon the Vienna talks. And the EU representative there saying that diplomacy is the only way for the West to get assurances about Iran's nuclear program and for Iran to be able to reap the benefits of the JCPOA, the whole objective of these Vienna talks. But what stage or what process are we currently looking at the moment? We're hearing that it's the United States that needs to make the necessary political decisions in order for these negotiations to move forward and a successful outcome to be achieved. The acting ambassador to the IAEA yesterday, addressing the Board of Governors, also said that he believes the talks have at this stage made significant progress and are very near to a successful conclusion, but this requires the right political decisions by the Americans. We're also hearing the same sentiments from officials in Iran at the Supreme National Security Council, which is effectively in charge of decision-making when it comes to the issue of the JCPOA talks. And also, Enrique Mora, just after Mr. Bagheri headed to Tehran for this brief visit and for consultations, Mora also tweeted saying that he believes now is the time for decision-making, and the assumption was that he is there referring to the need for the Americans to make the decision. So what are those decisions about? We know, of course, up until this stage, according to reports, that the outstanding issues pertain to the scope of sanctions relief that Iran is asking for, to the issue of economic and other guarantees that Iran wants from the Americans. And, of course, there was also the issue of the safeguards-related questions of the IAEA, which, you know, with the visit or trip by Mr. Grossi, is moving towards a positive direction, with expectations to conclude by the summer when the JCPOA, if indeed there is a conclusion, can be implemented.
All right, thanks a lot. Omar Lezgi joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Elsewhere, Pakistani women have taken to the streets in the city of Karachi to mark the International Women's Day. As Mama Turi reports, they use the occasion to call for the preservation of Islamic values.
"Not on my name anymore," the chant that echoed across Karachi against what many women in Pakistan call the West-funded and defined feminism in their country. Black-clad Muslim women are on the streets of Karachi to demand their Islamic rights in the face of distorted definition of freedom disseminated from the West.
Amidst Islamophobic anti-hijab policies, the West is also selling its brand of feminism under the garb of women's right that these women believe is targeting Muslim value system.
Speakers at the rally said that Islam is pretty clear on family and the role of its organizer, the woman. They noted that Muslims must not fall prey to Western pseudo-slogans of freedom that only objectify women.
Islam has empowered women through hijab, and Islam has given women their rights and empowered them while protecting themselves, while keeping their respect. And we're here to show them that we do not need to be objectified to be empowered, but we are empowered within our rights, and Islam is the beautiful religion that has given us this.
We all are here to show that hijab is our dignity, hijab gives us respect, and we feel no fear while we are in hijab.
As we all know that today is International Women's Day, and we have to show everyone that how Islam tells a real woman is. And as per Islam gives, and Islam tells that woman is equal to men, and Islam protects our rights.
Participants at the rally stress that they are here to show the world that Islam has given men and women equal rights.
Feminism is actually portraying an image that only certain kind of women can excel. Only the definition of women that they have, and only the definition of progress that they have, can lead to success. And whereas we believe that women have a right to decide for themselves, nobody has a right to tell them how to dress or how to step out of their homes. We have a right to cover ourselves if we want to, and we have a right to follow the religion which has given us all the rights in the world.
Unfortunately, our Jewish-controlled media has depicted women as worthless and has expressed them in an adulterated form. But we're here today to show the world that Islam has given men and women equal rights.
Participants shed light on violence against women and demanded the central government to implement more Islamic laws to prevent it. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Media reports suggest the United Arab Emirates is building residential units for Israel's military personnel at a joint base on Yemen's Socotra Islands. The reports say the buildings will be used by Israeli soldiers and military experts as well as their family. Sources close to Yemen's former Saudi-backed government say the new project aims to boost Tel Aviv's military presence in the strategic archipelago. They say Israel is trying to turn Socotra into a spy base to dominate major maritime routes. Overlooking the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, the islands connect the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. The UAE has reportedly been transporting Israelis to Socotra in the past months. Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi normalized relations in September 2020. South Koreans are going to the polls to elect their 20th president in a race branded by the media as the election of the unfavorables. From the 14 registered candidates, the two leading ones are Lee Jae-myung, who represents the ruling Democratic Party, and Yoon Suk-yeol from the conservative main opposition, People Power Party. Both candidates were running neck and neck in the latest polls, but scandals and accusations of corruption have left them largely unpopular. Whoever gets elected will replace incumbent President Moon Jae-in. For a five-year term, younger voters are said to have a pivotal role to play in this election. Soaring housing prices and inequalities, the COVID pandemic, unemployment, and anxiety over North Korea are the main challenges for the new administration. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Therefore, the goals of the revolution should be kept in sight. And in order to achieve the goals, there are certain needs, some of which are related to the short term, some are related to the present time, and some are related to the future. But preparations for meeting future needs should be made today. We must try to fulfill these needs to the best of our ability. This will bring about the movement of the continuation of the revolution, examples of which I will now present. Now, what are the goals of the revolution? The goals of the revolution are making progress, administering social justice, achieving power for the country, establishing an Islamic society, and ultimately forming the great and new Islamic civilization. These are the goals of the revolution. We must see what we should do to attain these goals. The attainment of social justice, real progress, not fake and shallow progress. Rather comprehensive progress in worldly and otherworldly areas, the attainment of an Islamic society in which the rules of Islam are completely implemented and the people benefit from the implementation, and the attainment of a new Islamic civilization. Then we should do those things within the scope of our capability. Everyone must do those things to the best of their capability. I, government officials, students, and other such people should carry out those tasks, each in a different way. I will expand on this later on.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I will cite examples in this regard. The efforts put in by scientists and researchers are a move to continue the revolution. The efforts and teachings of seminary and university scholars, the activities of the entrepreneurs and laborers, including in industry, agriculture, public services, and the like. These are all things that, when done, looking at the goals of the revolution, are examples of the continuation of the revolution. Efforts put in by young researchers, both in universities and Islamic seminaries.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the U.S. and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions. And countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former U.S. officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S. In case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the Laughlin government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and President Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years? The Western media's portrayal of Ukraine's suffering is somehow different compared to those suffering from wars in other countries like Yemen, Libya, Ethiopia, Palestine, and Syria has sparked widespread criticism. News coverage of civilian Ukrainians defending their country by making Molotov cocktails and arming themselves with state-given machine guns has also been celebrated as heroic, and these people have been called freedom fighters. This empathy has not been voiced for others, like Palestinians who experience an identical crisis, yet are labeled terrorists when defending their land. The suffering in Ukraine must be highlighted. However, portraying Ukraine's pain as more human shows the deep hypocrisy at play. Now, the West has come under criticism over what is seen as double standards regarding conflicts in other parts of the world.
You're happy to correctly use the most strong and robust language to describe the crimes against humanity of Vladimir Putin, but you will not use the same strength of language when it comes to describing the Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, when it is now being documented and detailed by two of the most respected human rights organizations in the world, and indeed has been alleged by dozens and dozens of non-governmental organizations, and to be honest, anybody who looks honestly.
Barrett asked whether the Irish Parliament will impose sanctions against Israel. He also asked whether the Irish legislative body would support calls for referring Israel to international courts over its crimes against humanity. This is not the first time the Western media has shown its bias. A similar narrative was pushed against Palestinians last year. Israel's decades-long occupation, its crippling blockade and military grip over Palestinians, as well as a wave of demolitions, led to a two-week war that killed around 260 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. News outlets and political figures spoke out on the conflict, but it started with the opposite end of the story, starting with Palestinian reactions and violence. While Israel was the real aggressor, they focused on rockets fired by the Hamas resistance movement that came later in retaliation. The double standards of the US and the West are the focal point of tension, violence, and bloodshed, and make Washington an unacceptable mediator and the country that is unable to achieve stability in the world. The war in Yemen is another example. Scant coverage of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis killed by arms from Western countries, especially the US. Yet the media portrays the real Yemeni army as the aggressor, and the ones doing the bombing as the ones who are following the path of righteousness. More than 1.3 million Ukrainians have fled their homeland so far since the beginning of the conflict with Russia. Countries like Hungary and Poland are being praised for letting in tens of thousands of people, and the EU is preparing measures that would offer temporary residence permits, as well as access to employment and social welfare. But the open-door policy of several states has highlighted an apparent double standard. These refugees can enter some countries more easily than those escaping violence in the Middle East or North Africa. For instance, Poland has welcomed those fleeing the Ukraine war while it pushed back against a wave of immigrants crossing over from Belarus, mostly from the Middle East and Africa, last year. Also, the reporting of this tragedy has seen double standards and Eurocentric bias that hold one group of human lives more valuable than others who are suffering conflicts in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
This was just one of many remarks on media outlets drawing the line between the conflict unfolding in Ukraine and those in other parts of the world. Many also drew a comparison between Europe's welcoming of Ukrainian refugees and the influx of Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans, which was declared a migrant crisis. The suffering of refugees from these countries is being played down and almost made to seem that their lives are not as important in comparison to the lives of those fleeing Ukraine. The Western media have been doing a biased reporting of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. The dehumanization of people of color, of those from countries that are not in the West, needs to stop. More needs to be done to improve for the future of building a united, wider society, which values every single person as a human being.
Russia's decision to attack Ukraine has ushered in a new era in its relations with the West. The United States and its allies are supplying Ukraine with arms and providing it with intelligence to fight Russian troops. But they are not directly involved in the clashes.
The only way to actually implement something like a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes into Ukrainian airspace and to shoot down Russian planes. And that could lead to a full-fledged war in Europe. President Biden has been clear that we are not going to get into a war with Russia.
Of course the U.S. doesn't want that, because if a war breaks out between the West and Russia, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. To avoid the doomsday scenario, the West has resorted to another form of warfare, the economic type. The United States and many of its allies have announced unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its financial, banking, and oil and gas sector, among others. These include sanctions on Russia's central bank, exclusion of several Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system, and a ban on Russian banks and companies' access to Western capital markets. In other words, Russia's engagement in dollar-denominated business will be severely affected. But let's not forget that for every action, there will be an opposite reaction.
Look, the dominance of the dollar has afforded America great global power, but it is now under real threat as never before, as Russia, China, and others economically challenge the US. Many are now seeking to ditch their dependence on the dollar, as Washington has continued to abuse its status as issuer of the world's reserve currency for decades, really, since after the Second World War.
Russia has already been working on plans to reduce its dependence on the trade in the dollar. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing for the opening of the Winter Olympic Games in China in early February and met with his Chinese counterpart. It was President Xi Jinping's first face-to-face meeting with another head of state in nearly 2 years, which highlights the importance of the visit. The two leaders discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. Russia has been pursuing the policy for a while. Back in April 2021, the share of Russian exports in dollars fell below 50% for the first time. Moscow's trade with Beijing is mostly responsible for the dive. There's room for improvement, though, as a majority of trade between China and Russia is done in euro, with just over 30% of the transactions conducted in their national currencies. The sweeping sanctions on Russia may push China to speed up measures to break with the US currency
and create its own means of payment. The obvious option is the yuan, which is getting stronger than ever. In July, international trade in the Chinese currency set a new record, with many predicting that at this rate, the yuan will become the world's third strongest currency by 2030.
Beijing has been actively encouraging the use of its currency in trade transactions, especially under its massive Belt and Road Initiative, with China recovering more strongly than other big nations after the COVID crisis that we've had. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as Beijing opens its financial markets.
This means only one thing. Given the economic alliance between China and Russia, the sanctions might temporarily hurt Moscow, but in the long run, the West will be disarmed of its economic pressure tool.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alcock, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong, but Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem that is largely blamed on Donald Trump. Tehran now says the sanctions must be removed in a verifiable manner, and Washington must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the agreement again. The United States has been dragging its feet so far, but Tehran says it will not back down from its red lines.
Iran can't go through the same thing again. I mean, in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally, abrogated the JCPOA, slapped on punitive sanctions. Iran had had 3.5 years of intense economic suffering, and it doesn't want to see that happen again. It doesn't want to sign some treaty. Only to see, to see the same thing happen either in, either later this year or in 2024 when, if Donald Trump is reelected.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani has warned that if the Vienna talks do not lead to a good deal, the current U.S. administration will feel defeated in the near future due to lack of timely use of diplomatic opportunities. As all eyes are on the venue of the talks in Vienna, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, will visit Tehran on Saturday to hold talks with Iran's nuclear chief and other top officials. The IAEA says the two sides will discuss outstanding safeguards issues with a view to addressing them. Does Grossi's trip boost the chances of a deal in Vienna? It is hard to guess at this point. The negotiations have been very complex, and there is no guarantee that they will end in a deal. It now seems that the fate of the diplomatic effort largely depends on whether the West will finally choose to make necessary political decisions.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kazim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kazim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام الإمامة هي النور وذلك قوله عز وجل: آمنوا بالله ورسوله والنور الذي أنزلنا. قال: النور هو الإمام.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, Imama is the light, and that is the support of his saying in the Quran, so have faith in Allah and his apostle and the light which we have sent down. Imam also said, the light is the Imam.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor, and it's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear brothers and sisters, we have been talking about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. This beautiful and divinely appointed Imam from the Ahlul Bayt, the family and the progeny, of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, has given us some very beautiful and profound statements in his dialogues with his companions. In one such instance, we find that the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, ordered his companions and his friends and his relatives to grant the needs of the people. In this conversation, he said to his companions and his friends, if a believer comes to his brother in religion for a need, then that person who has come to you is a mercy of Allah, the Blessed and the High. And if the individual who has been asked for a need accepts to fulfill the need of his brother or sister in religion, then he makes him follow Allah through us. And if the individual refuses to grant the need, and he could grant it, then Allah, the Mighty, the Blessed, empowers over him a snake created from fire to bite him in the grave until the day of resurrection. A very powerful conversation in which Imam al-Kadhim encourages and practically orders, for all intents and purposes, orders his companions and his friends to help your brothers and sisters in religion to the extent where this person who comes to you so that you grant their need is considered a mercy on behalf of Allah. And of course that you should accept granting the request of this individual, of course, if you can grant it. If you can't grant it, then either you find somebody who can help, or you very politely refuse or deny, but you give a dua to the individual. And finally, if one refuses to grant the need of this believing brother and sister, and they were able to grant it, Allah creates a snake which bites them in the grave until the day of judgment, the day of Qiyamah. The importance, dear friends, of fulfilling and helping our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters when they are in need. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam al-Kadhim is famous for this particular emphasis during his time. What he wanted to do was he saw there was a great deal of moral corruption. There was attachment to this world. The Abbasid caliphs were engrossed in the materialistic possessions of this world. They were drinking intoxicants. They were spending their time illegitimately with women. They were spreading fahisha and fahsha. And Imam alayhi salam rose to the challenge to correct this type of actions that were there and to spread these important teachings which highlight the need for you and I to hold ourselves accountable and to practice muhasaba every single day. Imam alayhi salam is telling us that without practicing this muhasaba, this self-accountability, one cannot be considered a follower of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and the Ahl al-Bayt alayhum as-salam. Why? The Quran comes forward and says, "Kafa bi nafsika al-yawma alayka hasiba." Sallallahu alayhi Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Imam Salamullahi alayhi says, when you hold yourself accountable every single day, that will allow you to strengthen your willpower, the power to say no to temptations, to desires, to the whims that you and I may have every single day when we're presented with all these challenges. Imam alayhi salam saw this particular opportunity to remind you and I of the importance of self-accountability. And he goes on to say that when it comes to this important action of muhasaba, one should reflect. If I have done a good deed, I should strengthen the resolve to continue performing it and to do more and more. But if, God forbid, I have committed an evil vice or a sin or an act of transgression against the Almighty subhanahu wa ta'ala, then the effort should be made and the commitment should be placed for that not to be repeated.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Iran and nuclear technology. In May 1945, a group of experts prepared a base to detonate 100 tons of TNT. They were busy finding an appropriate criterion to measure a huge bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The volume of the explosives should have been so large to simulate the main test. In the middle of all this, the differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in their right.
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost. Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter